Welcome to 1 hour of the toughest, roughest wrestling you'll ever see.
That's right, Dick the Bruiser, set it off.
The big question, have you got the endurance? Have you got the brains to get past the excellence of execution?
Where are all the gutless American wrestlers? Step in the ring with the Baron and face the brave.
The reason why Ax and myself were put on this earth is to demolish people.
Bobby Heenan, that is a very good-looking sport coat you've got on.
Yeah, and I paid for mine. Mine isn't government issue.
Yellow, everybody. Lance Russell and Dave Brown right along ringside. By golly, we're ready to go with another big week of championship wrestling.
Greetings, wrestling fans, and welcome to Wrestling Nostalgia. I'm your host, Dave Dynasty. Thank you for joining us for another great episode, right? Because that's what we have around here. We have fun. We talk about the history of wrestling. We remember the good times, and we just have a blast. We have a great guest on today, Ed Helsinki. Ed was with the WWF from 1983 to 1987, first as a magazine editor, and then he worked in the marketing and merchandise department. Lots of great stories talking to him. Probably a whole side of wrestling that you don't really hear about. You don't really get to take a peek into. So something a little kind of fresh and original. I'm excited for you to hear that later on. Before you get there, make sure you subscribe to the podcast. We're available on all podcast platforms. And whichever one you prefer, make sure you subscribe. And then rate and review us if possible. And share the episodes when they're out there. Be sure to keep up on the show and keep up on me. Best way to do that is to follow me on X, formerly known as Twitter. I am at The Dave Dynasty. Right there you can find all the information about all my projects and everything that is going on, plus lots of historical wrestling shares, information, pictures, dates, title changes, all kinds of cool stuff. So follow me there. And while you're out there following me, make sure you subscribe to me on YouTube. It's at youtube.com/TheDaveDynasty. Lots of wrestling content up there, including this podcast, but also lots of actual wrestling content, television episodes, matches, etc., etc. Lots of cool stuff up on the YouTube channel. And if you really want to support the show, the best way to do that, financially speaking, is to go buy one of our shirts. Go to prowrestlingtees.com/TheDaveDynasty. We have a slew of designs there for you to choose from. So go buy one for you, buy one for a friend, and support Wrestling Nostalgia. And while you're out there supporting things, support our friends of the show, the Ultimate Classic Wrestling Channel. It's available at classicwrestling.net, or you can download the app on Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, iOS Mobile, and Android Mobile. You sign up, there's a small monthly fee, but it is so worth it for the content that you're getting all the time. So much wrestling to watch on there, so much wrestling being added all the time, and they've only just scraped the surface. They have so many tapes that they're working to convert and add. Go check it out. You'll be glad you did. And of course, Wrestling Nostalgia is part of the WrestleCopia family of shows. So go check out all the amazing podcasts with great hosts that are part of the network. They all shine a light on wrestling history. Go to WrestleCopia.com, or you can look up the shows on any podcast platform that you choose. Like the one that you subscribed to us on, right? We spoke with that earlier. Have you done it yet? Well, you're listening to us right now, so just hit that subscribe. Do it. You're already there. All right, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll have that interview with Ed Helsinki, so stick around. This is Listen to Their Screams, a horror podcast that feels like you're chatting with friends. Hello, I am one of your friends, Dave. I am one of the co-hosts of Listen to Their Screams with my friend, Ike, and we want you to come and check us out. We are a fun-filled, positive horror movie podcast that does reviews, news, birthdays, anniversaries. We play games. We are a ton of fun every week for you, the horror fan out there. For all of our links to our social media and the podcast platforms, just check out our link tree. It is linktr.ee/listen2screams. That is listen, the number 2, and screams. Or look us up on your favorite social media platform and podcast provider. And welcome back to Wrestling Nostalgia. I'm your host, Dave Dynasty, and we're being joined now by a former WWF Magazine editor, Ed Helsinki. Ed, how are you?
I'm good, DD. How you doing today, bro?
I'm good. I'm good. Let's talk a little bit. I know you've got some interesting stories. This is a very interesting take to the wrestling business from what we're used to talking about. But let's talk about, where did you grow up, and did you grow up a fan of professional wrestling?
I grew up in Western New York in a city called North Tonawanda, which is between Buffalo, which is between Buffalo and Niagara Falls. Did I grow up as a wrestling fan? Sure, I did, because as a little boy, we had wrestling on the local station every Friday night, and we had the opportunity to watch wrestling from Hamilton, Ontario, and Toronto, Ontario. So we had our pick of the litter, seeing the different promotions that were going on at that time. Maple Leaf Wrestling, and then they did something with Detroit, and we would have, we would see guys like George Crybaby Cannon and Sweet Daddy Siki and Lord Athol Layton and Dewey Robertson before he became the Missing
Missing
Link.
link.
So, I mean, we grew up on all that stuff. So we got a pretty good education about wrestling, and of course, being knucklehead kids, we would get the kids in the neighborhood, and we'd have our own matches out on the lawns and that until the parents came out and said, and set us straight and broke up our hijinks and all our fun.
Well, tell us, what is your work and school background like prior to the WWF?
Oh God.
Well, I mean, I guess what I'm getting at is what is your major? What was your career path prior to going to the de working with the WWF?
My career path was to be a sports writer and work my way up the chain with newspapers. I'm an Indiana University grad, a proud IU grad from Bloomington.
All right. I grew up I born and raised in Columbus, Indiana, about 45 minutes from there.
I know where Columbus, Indiana is because the IU hockey team used to practice in Columbus, Indiana. That's the only place where we could get ice time, and we would, come into Columbus for practice at 11 o'clock or midnight. So I mean, oh God, yes, Columbus, Indiana. We saw a lot of it at nighttime, but I mean, it looked nice. So, what are you gonna do? No, so that was my career path to become a sports writer, mainline sports writing, and graduated from IU. Moved back to Buffalo again. Worked at a couple newspapers. One happened to close, called the Buffalo Courier Express. Rupert Murdoch was going to buy the newspaper. However, he wanted concessions from the union, and things just fell apart, and the paper ended up closing. And about a year later, there was a job opening here in Auburn, New York, at the Citizen, and I applied for it. And lo and behold, I moved here in 1982, and then about 5 months later, 6 months later, a press release came across our desk saying a WWF wrestling show was coming to Cuba Community College, and that kind of like set everything else in motion at that point. I wanted to do a piece on professional wrestling, and I understood it and had a good idea of it and tried to talk my way into it and was very, very successful with doing it.
So then how does that parlay then to you winding up working for the WWF?
Well, the wrestling, one of the stipulations for being allowed in to cover the wrestling show was to write whatever we did, send to them. I assured them that it wasn't going to be a slam piece about wrestling being fake or not on the up and up. I understood what wrestling was about, and I wanted to do something respectful and introspective piece about it. So the wrestling show happened on a Thursday night. The college gymnasium was packed. A lot of excitement in the air. I think the show went maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours. That's back when the WWF was doing three tiers type of wrestling. They did the high schools and the small colleges, or then they did the mid-major arenas like maybe Syracuse or Rochester and or Springfield, Mass. They worked out the different angles, the different finishes before the shows with guys would be booked for like Madison Square Garden or the Philadelphia Spectrum or Boston Garden or the Hartford Civic Center. So it was a tier system. So the show went off at Cougar Community College. I did a piece on Friday talking about, do you remember how wrestling was? and talking about guys like Sweet Daddy Steaky and Tex McKenzie and Lord Athol Layton. And then it became with Sweet Hansen and Sergeant Slaughter at that point. So, and on a Sunday, the photographer who came with me, a guy named Steve Taylor, he did a picture page, and that's when newspapers used to do picture pages. And it was a great piece that was done on it. And Steve, a phenomenal photographer. And so that appeared on Sunday. And I kept my word. Sunday afternoon, I had everything, you know, in an envelope, mailed it off to a guy named Ed Cohen. And when the WWF was located on Cape Cod, and mailed it off. And 3 days later, I get a phone call from Ed, and he says, "Hey, love your stuff. Hey, we're starting a magazine. Would you guys be interested in flying down here to the Cape to interview for, you know, the editorial spots?" And, you know, I'm 25 years old, you know, single, footloose, fancy free. And I said, sure. I didn't know about Steve at that point because he was married. And how would his wife feel about something like that? But he took the interview as well. We flew down to Cape Cod, and about a week later, we were hired on the spot and negotiated our pay and negotiated our start day, which was going to be about 5 weeks later. It was July 31st, 1983. Our first show was Madison Square Garden. So we started right at the top, right out of the box.
So you got hired on then as the magazine was starting up, right? As they brought it in-house, because they had Keiter, I think, doing some of the stuff before when he did the programs and different things, right?
Yeah, I mean, they had a couple people beforehand, and it was in-house, it was out of house. And they brought us in. The first magazine we did was called Victory. We had Sergeant Slaughter on the cover.
Right.
However, we had to change. Nobody checked. You know, is Victory a good name for it? Because Stanley Weston, his Pro Wrestling Illustrated magazines, had up in the masthead Victory series. So, you know, the lawyer from Stanley Weston's, you know, company came with a cease and desist letter and said, "Now you can't use this, guys, or we're going to sue you." And so they changed the magazine to the official WWF magazine at that point. And, you know, we made our publisher a fictitious woman named Linda Kelly, who was actually Linda McMahon. you know, a lot of the people on the Titan Sports crew at that point were, you know, appeared in the masthead. So that's how it started at that point. It was interesting. And it just began right away, whirlwind. When they brought us in, they put us up in a house, several of us, on the Cape in South Yarmouth. We were there August, September. I mean, we're technically supposed to stay August, September, October, 3 months. But we were on the road a lot at that point. I mean, we were indoctrinated really quickly. I mean, we were going from town to town. You know, we went to TV taping at that point. It was Allentown one night and Hamburg, Pennsylvania. And that was every 3 weeks. And we got a quick education. I mean, I was very grateful to Fred Blassie. He became my mentor in the business. He took me under his wing right away. You know, Fred was like a second father to me. My father passed away in 1981, and Fred, 2 years later, ended up, you know, being my guiding light in the sea of darkness, so to speak.
So, obviously, right, when you come in, this is just as Vince Jr. had taken control, right, of
yes,
and formed Titan. What kind of creative control did you guys have? How much guidance did they give you on what should appear, on who should appear on the cover? How much of that was dictated to you, or how did it work at that time?
A lot of it was what side of the bed Vince woke up at on any given day. We thought we had some editorial control and creativity, but in essence, we really didn't. The nature of the business was things were changing, and things were changing quickly. Wrestlers were coming in and coming going out. I mean, new talent was coming in from different territories. Every television taping, there would be four, five, six guys that came in from other territories. Vince was building quite the stable, and he was going with the more of the cartoon characters and building big, bold personalities as opposed to the old wrestling stereotypes and personalities of years gone by. So it was quite the change. And, you know, the only official writer was me. And, you know, you would have guys like Howard Finkel, but a lot of the storylines were done and created by the wrestlers themselves and then by the road agents. And that, you know, they were able to work different angles on the different tier shows, high school, college, you know, mid-major arenas before they took it to the big places. So they knew what drew a lot of heat, what got a lot of response, what work needed to be done, and what was going to be a finished product. However, it wasn't a perfect scenario because people being human, people make mistakes, people get hurt, people don't like it, people get an attitude, people get fired. And so things could change in a heartbeat, coming from Vince. And a lot of times it did. Was it frustrating to us? Oh, absolutely. Did we have to spin and pivot rather quickly? Sure. But we didn't have the luxury of computers. We were doing everything manually on, you know, Selectric typewriters at that point. I mean, this was rather, it was way back when. And so it would get a little bit annoying at that point. And it took a lot out of a guy like me because I came from straight journalism and I was doing fiction at that point. And in a lot of ways, it cost me going back because I crossed that line. And then you couldn't go back. I mean, and that's a chance that you took, but it was an exciting chance to do it. I mean, I give Vince a lot of credit. I was able to do some radio for him as well, too. I was easy ed on Z100 in New York City doing the World Wrestling Federation report, you know, after shows at the Madison Square Garden or the Meadowlands in New Jersey or Nassau Coliseum. So that was kind of cool. Or Vince said, hey, for the magazine, we did a bunch of commercials for Victory Magazine. He said, Vince says, hey, write some TV commercials. I'd never written a TV commercial in my life, but I tried, you know, given the opportunity. And we had guys like Lord Athol, or Lord Alfred Hayes, who could pull it off and make it, you know, something sound crappy, make it sound really, really good. So, I mean, there were a lot of things that we were able to do. And Vince was just brilliant about how he wanted things done and where he was taking this company so quickly. And he says, I'm going to take over the country and I'm going to take over the world. And he said that way back then.
So, okay. So were you publishing monthly or bi-monthly at that? What was your print?
We did both. We did the program that we did the monthly program for the arenas. I think the print run for the monthly programs was 30,000. And the magazine was 50,000, and so we were doing that. I mean, you know, a lot of things were on a shoestring budget at that point as well, too. Vince had the mandate; he had to pay his father back $1 million and his partners within a year, or everything goes back.
Right.
And
yeah,
those partners were, you know, Vince Senior, Phil Zacco, Gorilla Monsoon, Arnie Skolin. So I mean, Arnie was a road agent. Monsoon had become a road agent at that point. Didn't know where Zacco was in the picture. And Vince Senior would come around once in a while until he got sick and he ended up passing away in May of 1984. So, you know, things were going quickly. Oh my goodness. It was big and bold and brash. And, you know, once we hooked up with, USA Cable Network, things changed. That was huge.
Yeah, of course. So
I mean, that's when the businesses took off, started taking off at that point.
Yeah, so in doing this magazine, did you get to do some things where with you know you guys did some, I don't know, like unique photo shoots with wrestlers and things, or was it all action shots? Was it a mixture? Did you just do whatever you could, try a little of this and that? Kind of what was your approach to the magazine at that time?
It was action shots from arenas, and Steve Taylor did a phenomenal job. But we also did some promotional shoots. Back then, the heat was Sergeant Slaughter and the Iron Sheik. So one day we go to the United Nations. Fred Blassie, the Iron Sheik. I'm driving the company car. You know, it's and Steve Taylor's in the front seat next to me. So we go to the United Nations, and the Sheik is in the back, and he's got the Khomeini flag in his little metal carry-on, and they've got the headdress on, and Blassie's got his on as well, too. And you pull up to the United Nations, and you got a double park, first of all. But we pulled up right in front of where all the flags were. Yeah. And I said, boys, probably not going to have a lot of time for doing this. And, okay, we'll take care of it. So when the Sheik got out there, he had that Khomeini flag already. He was waving it. And, of course, Fred Blassie's yelling, Bali, 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 and just stoking up anybody who would listen. And within 2 minutes or 3 minutes, you could see all the buildings around, the activity, and people were streaming out of the buildings to see exactly what the hell was going on in front of the United Nations. I was getting a little nervous at that point. I didn't know whether, you know, we were going to get shot, we were going to get arrested, you know, what was going to happen with this. So, you know, I'm yelling to Steve, come on, step it up, we got to get going. And they did. And they were literally running into the car. And I remember Blassie and Sheiky just laughing like two little boys, thinking it was the best thing since sliced bread. I mean, they were the heat, the nuclear heat that was created on something like that. And I'm driving the company Lincoln Town Car out of there and praying to God that nobody was going to follow us. We weren't going to get arrested. Nobody was going to take a shot at us. Because at that time, the country was on edge with the coming off the Iranian hostage situation. And yeah, things were not good with the United States and Iran. But the Sheik, Cosgrove really played it really, really well. I mean, he was the perfect heel for that. And, of course, he was from Iran as well, too. The funny part, he was a bodyguard at one time for the Shah of Iran. So, yeah. We had that. The other time that I can remember, we did a photo shoot with Sergeant Slaughter in Washington. And we did it on a Sunday morning. We did it maybe about 8:30 in the morning. This way, it's early. We're not going to cause a lot of commotion. We'll come in and we'll get out of there, and things will be good, you know? So I parked maybe a block away from the White House. That's when you could do it back then. And Steve is in front of the White House outside the gate with Slaughter and our friend, I should say. And first thing you know, here comes a couple of guys in suits talking in their cufflinks. And the first pair goes by, doesn't say anything to us. And then 2 minutes later, here comes the second pair from the other way coming by, talking into their cufflinks. Don't stop in any way, shape, or form. Just keep walking down the sidewalk. And then here comes the third set. And this time they stopped and they said, Mr. Holinsky, how long will you and Mr. Slaughter and Mr. Taylor be here? I think we're almost done, but, you know, sorry, we're not trying to cause a commotion or anything like this. You know, I'm sorry if we've been a bother. Said, no bother, but if we knew you were coming, we would have gotten you in the White House grounds to do this. I said, well, you know, who knew? I mean, and how are you going to get through to the White House? And yeah, are they going to believe you at that point or anything like that? So we went to other places in Washington, the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, which is a very solemn place. Mm-hmm. However, we got there and you got some people chirping, USA, USA, you know, go Sergeant Slaughter, down with Iran. And it's really not the place to do that or to hear that. I mean, it's very solemn. So we left there rather quickly, and we went to, in front of the statue of Iwo Jima. And, you know, Sarge is putting his hands like together, like he's holding the flag, but we can transpose it later. And we had fun with that. And then we were driving around, and I said, oh, look, there's an entrance to the Pentagon. Hey, I'll take it and see what happens. And so I turned in and got maybe an eighth of a mile. I look up, and here's three cars side by side by side coming at me. I'm saying, this is not good. Now I got Slaughter in the back. Taylor's to the right of me. And so I turn her around. Now I'm driving a lime green 1979 Chevy Malibu, two-door, vinyl seats, no air conditioning. And it's October of 1983. And so I turn around. I put my signal on, you know, play it straight. Just drive off back the other way. Of course, they pull me over. And one of the MPs comes along the car. He's got his hand on his holster and state your business. And I said, well, we're with the World Wrestling Federation. I'm Ed Helsinki. He's Steve Taylor. And we're doing a photo shoot here in Washington with Sergeant Slaughter, who's in the back. And the officer looks, the MP looks in and goes, my God, it is Slaughter. And Slaughter in character just saluted him some at ease, man. And I said, I'm really, really sorry. I took, you know, the wrong turn in, and, you know, it's just a huge mistake. I'm thinking we're going to get arrested or whatever it was. And he goes, okay, well, that's fine. Follow me out. And I'll escort you out. Okay, great. And so we're being escorted out, and I'm saying this, Taylor and Slaughter. I said, please don't laugh. You know, hold your laughter until we turn the corner. We're not escorted anymore, because I mean, this is pretty funny, but I mean, and we'll always remember this to the day we die.
Yeah. Well, and you you moved to marketing and merchandise, right? And worked there from 84 to 87 or so.
Yeah.
So tell us, what did that role involve at that time in the WWF?
It was an explosion. T-shirts, everything that was If we couldn't get people to buy tickets at shows, we were taking their money from in merchandising. If you saw our wrestling shows, taped it at Allentown in Hamburg, you always saw people in the first two rows with brand new WWF merchandise, Hulkamania headbands, T-shirts, the magazines, the programs, wristbands, posters, foam fingers, and those were planted on purpose, and because we were appealing to the younger generation, and we were appealing to the younger generation's parents' wallet at that point. So that was an then, you know, then we did in the magazine, calendars, we did, you know, buy Hulk Hogan posters, Jimmy Snuka fingers, Hulk Hogan fingers. And it just took off. And on top of that, we were then supplying the live shows with merchandise as well, too. We were dipping out of the same inventory. So that brought up a whole set of challenges on trying to keep merchandise in stock. I mean, sometimes we got so bad that we were like, 6 weeks before we could fulfill a mail order because we just didn't have the stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it was flying off the shelves at the venues. And at that point, you know, we were doing at least two, sometimes three shows a night. On weekends, we'd have on Saturday and Sunday, six shows between those 2 days. So there, the explosion of merchandise was insane. And a lot of times we just couldn't keep things in stock. Anything, when Hulk became champion, anything that was yellow and said Hulkamania on it was sold immediately. It didn't matter if it was in yellow or if it was in red. It was a soul. That's how hot he was.
Yeah. Well, and around the same time that you moved to marketing is when the WWF signed their action figure line with LGN. Was there, did you have any involvement in that with what you guys did in, the, in that licensing of that to LJN?
No, we were on the back end of the fulfillment of that. I mean, we found out right away. We found out, oh my God, we're doing a toy deal with LJN. And what happened because of that, Sergeant Slaughter, you know, ended up leaving because he had a toy deal with Hasbro.
Yeah, right.
And Vince didn't want it, couldn't stand it because, number one, he couldn't get a piece of it. And number two, it would conflict with LJN and it wouldn't look good. So, you know, Slaughter decided he was going to leave. And it got messy with Vince and Slaughter. You got to understand back then, Vince was these characters. He was trademarking their names, these wrestlers.
Yeah.
Except Slaughter. Slaughter had already trademarked his name in the mid-70s.
Right.
When he came up with the Sergeant Slaughter gimmick. Mm-hmm. And so Vince couldn't get a piece of that. He was furious. There was a meeting with Slaughter and his attorney and Vince. And first of all, Vince didn't like attorneys. So when that meeting went down, I mean, Vince was fuming about that. I mean, Sarge and I are good friends to this day. I caught up with him a couple months ago here in Syracuse. And he was telling that story. I mean, and you know, the funny thing about it, when Sarge left and didn't go make his last event, I'm sitting in a bar with him in Darien, Connecticut, saying, you know, when he's ready to bolt the WWF and was leaving without any notice. And I thought to myself, oh, my God, if anybody finds out that I'm here, I'm toast, you know that. But now I can say it later. I mean, it's 40 years later. I mean, I think a statute of limitations is well over with by now. So, but yeah, I mean, a lot of things changed. Then we had, then the toy orders. Then we had the toy rings. So, I mean, the business was just absolutely crazy at that point, and the money was flowing in. I don't know if it was priced correctly or not, but... because a lot of us, I didn't have experience in marketing and merchandising at that point. I mean, it was a newspaper guy. The guy that they had in charge of it, Robert DeBoard, he didn't have that experience as well either. He was just friends with Vince and Linda McMahon, he and his wife. So, I mean, a lot of that was trial and error and learn on the job. So were there mistakes made? Yeah, there were some. Did anybody lose an eye or, anything else? No. But did they realize as much money that they could have? No. No doubt about that. They tried to keep the pricing family friendly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was kind of the market direction back then, though, right? Now, it's not like today where it's targeted at collectors, right? It's back then the thinking was, well, the kids will want these figures. So you got to make it where the parent will buy it for the kid.
Right. Right?
And stuff like that. So, you had to walk that balance, but merchandising to this level was all new to the wrestling business, right? I mean, there, people had sold pictures and there've been a few guys that have sold shirts and things like that. But prior to this boom, none of this.
They learned a lot of it from the AWA and apparently Vern was selling a lot of stuff at that point. And actually it was Hulk who brought it up to Vince about that, saying, man, you guys should be selling merchandise at this point. And back then, the AWA were doing wrestler music intros, and nobody else was doing that. So, I mean, we took a lot, we took a lot out of there from the different territories, including their wrestlers, took some of their ideas and their talent and put them all out of business one by one.
Yeah. Yeah. And while, like I said, these WWF figures, the action figures, right, took it to a new level, right? Vern was the first to have wrestling action figures in the U.S. with Remco. He did it first, but they weren't as successful and weren't on the same level. Right. Yeah. You're right though. Vern, had shirts and everything else, but Vince took these ideals and, like you said, and everything else, and just, he took it next level and, really got behind it. And of course it doesn't hurt when you have a Hulk Hogan to slap on all this stuff.
Vince was more effective, in my opinion. Vince was more effective with TV.
Sure, yeah.
He, you know, Vern was, you know, the old-fashioned wrestlers. He didn't care for the cartoon characters. He didn't care for Hulk Hogan. He wasn't going to make him champion.
Yep, right.
You know, he preferred the Nick Bockwinkles and the Baron Von Raschkes. And don't get me wrong, those guys are great guys. They're great wrestlers. And they serve the purpose. But that field, and Vern made himself champion a few times because, you know, he had the amateur background. So, I mean, that had its own niche, and that's okay. But Vince took it in a different way, and we're going to – and these guys are going to become bigger than life. I remember Vince telling me, you know, I can make anybody a superstar. Right? But, you know, they piss me off out of sight, out of mind. I take them off TV. People forget about them. They're done at that point. So that was always huge. And then back then, it was always the wars to get on TV in Cincinnati, St. Louis, Kansas City. All these wrestling hotbeds and all these territories. Even Indianapolis at that point. So, I mean, it was huge to come in there. But then Vince was smart enough to hire Jim Barnett, who had worked all those territories beforehand.
Yep. Sure did,
and I got to know Mr. Barnett really well. I stayed always an arm's length away from him at that point, you know, because he was the most flamboyant gay man I ever met in my life and to this day. And I don't say that in a condescending manner. I mean, it's just like, Ed, my boy. And that was Mr. Barnett.
Yeah.
But he had a side to him that people don't realize that, you know, they talk about trying to commit suicide in 1987. But if my memory serves me correctly, he tried to commit suicide back in 1985. He was hospitalized for it. And he said to me, he asked me why I didn't come visit him in the hospital. And I said, you know, I said, Mr. Barnett, my father died in the hospital with just he and I, not too long ago, a few years ago. I said, me in hospitals and seeing somebody in there like that doesn't go over well.
Yeah.
But I believe he tried to commit suicide when he brokered that deal for Vince, the Black Saturday, when Vince got on TBS.
Yeah, TBS, yeah.
So, I mean, there was just some crazy stuff that went on, nutty stuff, and there were never 2 days that were alike. There were no, being in the wrestling business was insane. I remember my mother asking me once, she says, are you working for the mob? I said, well, I said, if you consider it the Irish mob, yeah, then sure, yeah, I am. I mean, it's just like, you know, why do you have to, you know, leave, fly out the day after Christmas to go back, you know, for a wrestling show at Madison Square Garden? Well, you can't tell you tell your mother, she's not going to understand that the Iron Sheik is probably going to win the title over Bob Backlund, which happened on December, you know, 26, 1983.
Yeah.
You know, and then a month later, he's dropping the belt to Hulk Hogan.
Yeah.
I mean, then it was really nuts. Or, you know, later in 84, when John Stossel's getting the hell beat out of him by Dave Schultz. Dave Schultz,
yeah.
And I'm not more than 10, 15 feet away from it when it happened. And, you know, and Stossel, you know, being the idiot that he was, asking Schultz if it's fake.
Oh, yeah.
And Schultz, you know, there's no doubt in my mind Dave Schultz took his marching orders from Vince. And he took the fall for it. And it cost him his career.
Yeah.
I mean, Vince hung him out to dry. At that point,
yeah,
because this thing exploded and it wasn't in a good way. But you know, then we hooked up with MTB and the Rock and Wrestling Connection,
right?
And then we became mainstream. You know, then we're talking about WrestleMania. You know, it's like holy smokes! Go ahead.
What was that like from within the company? Because right, that had. I mean, now it's a commonplace, right? We know everybody knows what WrestleMania is. Everybody knows what these super shows are and blah, blah, blah. This was, I mean, while there had been big shows before, there had been nothing attempted like this, right? And Vince, Vince was essentially risking the company's well-being on this being a success, right?
Well, that's a story that always has been told.
Of course, right.
But Bob McMullen, who was the CFO at the time, and Brad Balogun, who just did his book, The Six Pack.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Interviewed McMullen, and McMullen had all the records from then still. He had a copy of it. He said, no. Would it set the company back a little bit? Yes. Would it put him out of business? No. But that was always the talk about that. Now, you know, the old Capital Wrestling, the WWWF, I mean, did they do shows at Shea Stadium? Yeah, they did.
Yep.
They were always in Madison Square Garden every month.
Yep.
That, though, you know, they sold out the Garden for years. I mean, I think the gate was always up right around $180,000. What they, you know, with Jim Troy and his experience with pay-per-view and the foresight taking this and having closed circuit in these yep. big arenas like Pittsburgh or Philadelphia or anywhere in North America, and then we're sending WrestleMania programs to all those venues, and they're and some of those venues we're sending clothing to sell. That was where the risk was, you know. Sure. You had, but have, you know, putting on a spectacular show like this, it's I'm sure it scared the shit out of all the other promoters across the United States, Vern and Don Owen and mm-hmm. Graham and Bill Watts, you know, Jim Crockett. They were all wondering, like, is this really going to happen? And when it did, and they brought in Muhammad Ali and Billy Martin and Liberace and it's like, and then the night before that, they got Mr. T and Hulk Hogan on Saturday Night Live.
Absolutely, yep.
And I'm sitting fifth row ringside at WrestleMania 1, and sitting behind me is Billy Crystal. Yeah. And I just turned to him and his wife, and I say, hey, Billy, great show last night. He doesn't know me from a bag of peanuts, but, you know, it's you fake it till you make it. And that's what made it a lot of fun at that point. And then, you know, the after party that we had for that on top of Rockefeller Plaza, and the name of the restaurant escapes me, but was just insane. And it was a huge success at that point. It really, really was. And then we knew that we could do it again. Except Vince the next year got greedy and got a little stupid with WrestleMania 2.
Right.
You know, Nassau Coliseum, the Rosemont Horizon, and the LA Sports Arena, you know? Yeah. And then you got the NFL players in there as well, involved with that as well, too. And some of these guys could be dangerous because they're shooting instead of wrestling. So, but then that was the only WrestleMania ever on a Monday. So, you know, that was a historical with that. Yeah. And then WrestleMania 3, we didn't know how big that was going to be. But putting it at in Detroit like that, the Pontiac Silverdome was brilliant because you had the Canadian market to draw from.
Sure.
You had the Midwest market to draw from. People could fly from the East Coast rather easily to make it to there. And to have, you know, whatever you want to call it, whether it was 78,000 or 93,000 people there, was just simply amazing. I mean, I sat in the booth area of Bill Davidson, who owned the Detroit Pistons and Tampa Bay hockey team at that point. And if you looked at Bill, he just looked like a plain guy off the street, but he just was fascinated by how much money was being thrown at and how much money was being collected for this show. We did $550,000 in merchandise that afternoon.
Ooh,
that's 1987. Today, it's $1.55 million that we did in today's dollars. So there was a lot of stuff that went on. And oh, my God, we ended up emptying the warehouse to send it to the Pontiac. And then we were also moving out of that warehouse. So we didn't have to move that stuff. It had already gone to Pontiac, and we didn't get a lot back coming back. So, I mean, that's the beauty of it at that point.
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier, you mentioned the rock and wrestling connection, right? With to backtrack a little, with David Wolf and Cyndi Lauper, all that. But one curious thing that sometimes is forgotten, and I'm curious if you were around, is that are the Fabulous Freebirds having a brief stint there in the WWF with David Wolf and everything? Were you around during any of that that
Yeah, we
brief stint?
were, but you know, they didn't.
Well, from your perspective, what was the where it didn't fit? What happened there that caused that to be such a brief stay, and for the Freebirds to come in and out so quick?
You know, it's a change of culture. You're bringing guys from the a lot of them from the Deep South. I mean, they wrestled in Fritz Von Erich territory for many years, and there just wasn't a click or there wasn't a connection when they came up to the Northeast. And that didn't just happen with them. That happened with a few other people as well too. I mean, and you could only gimmick them up so much. The Freebirds were gods in the South,
Yeah, sure.
and but. It just didn't, they just didn't get over in the Northeast. Maybe it was the timing was wrong on something. There was a lot of stuff going on simultaneously. And, you know, I think in a lot of ways, something had to give. And that was it. People were absorbed with Roddy. You know, Piper brought on a lot of heat and they brought on a lot of publicity, brought a lot of interest in there. And, you had Hogan on there as well too. You had Cyndi Lauper and David Wolf. You had Captain Lou Albano with his big personality. There wasn't a lot of room to bring anybody else into that. It really
Sure.
wasn't, and I think that's what went wrong with the Freebirds.
Well, like, and then we go circle back, right? You were working in the merchandise. From this time period where you worked in the marketing and merchandise, do you remember? What? Tell me something that's an odd piece of merchandise that you remember from your time around there that you looked at and thought, "Wow, why are we, licensing that, or why are we putting that out?" What's something that? I mean, or was there something that you saw that was just very peculiar and odd to you?
That's a good question. I gotta rack my brains on something. You know what was goofy? Buttons, and for the simple reason that, you know, you're selling these buttons for $2, $3, and $4. But number two, buttons with the, you could stab somebody. You could maim somebody with. You could poke an eye out with it. I mean, you could commit assault with them and. Why are we selling these things? And better yet, why are we selling these things to kids? That to me, that didn't make any sense. Like, no, something's going to go wrong, and there's going to be lawsuits, and that's going to be a big problem. But yeah, buttons were always goofy. That it didn't make any sense. You know, the other thing, keychains too. I didn't understand that either. Why are we selling keychains to a kid?
No keys.
Yeah, no
What's he?
keys, no car. You don't need it for your bike. So I mean, why are we? I get it with the headbands and the wristbands, with the Hulkamania stuff, and you know, and we ended up with we were doing the Cobra Corps in '84 with Sergeant Slaughter before he left, and they couldn't. We sold it, and had all these orders that came in, but we couldn't fulfill the orders because we didn't have all the merchandise in. They came up with these ideas, but didn't have the wherewithal to get the suppliers on board or find the correct supplier or price it out correctly. I mean, that's some of the mistakes that were made. I mean, we were putting the cart before the horse way too many times back then.
Well, do you have any memorabilia or keepsakes or merchandise that you kept from your time, or something that?
Oh, well, I have a couple of things. I have my, Cobra Corps in '84 Sergeant Slaughter, bag with the snake and the tongue and things like that. I think I got some Hulkamania shirts. I got a lot of it up in the attic that I haven't looked at in probably 30 years. But I got this young grandson who probably is going to get a lot of this stuff. So, and that's okay. I mean, Yeah. I mean,
But it'll
but
especially be cool because not only will he get, the merchandise, right, and this and that, but you'll get to tell you some of the stories, right?
I mean, well, exactly. With Brad Belugin's book, The Six Pack, and I'm gonna put a plug in for it because
Oh,
it's
absolutely.
done.
I've got the book. It's a great book.
I mean, I appear on pages 118 to 122 and page 124. So, I mean,
There you go.
I made 5 pages out of 304 pages in the book. So, if you're looking for a book with a lot of picture pages on it, there aren't any, guys. There's only one, and that's the wrestling card from December 26, 1983. But when Brad contacted me a couple of years ago, it's just like, who are you and how did you get a hold of me? And because I really don't talk about this. I mean, I've maintained a low key, but I figured, after 35, 40 years, it's okay to talk about it now. I'm not, I have no grudges to no axes to grind with people. And I felt very, very honored to be part of the business. I mean, to be invited into this fraternity of wrestlers. And I still believe kayfabe is a sacred thing. I mean, you had to earn your stripes. I mean, guys like Andre the Giant did not take well to people. It took me about 2 years to become friends with Andre the Giant. I mean, he was very, he didn't want you, if you didn't belong in the dressing room, get out, or he would literally chase you. And he wasn't screwing around with you. I mean, he would play his cards with Arnie Skoland and a few of the other boys. And Andre used to like to drink white wine by the gallon, in a gallon jug with the glass handle. He used to do that at television taping, at promos, and he'd be on the second gallon when he got his personality ready to get on the camera for promos, but Andre lived couldn't live a normal life as a professional wrestler. He was a big man, a freak of nature, so to speak. But he couldn't do the simple things in life. He couldn't sleep in a normal bed. He couldn't ride in a normal car. He couldn't. He had to have two seats on an airplane. In the stories that they talk about him and drinking, they're all true. I remember, after I left the business, I caught up with him and Tim White. And Tim White was an usher in our wedding. And Tim was a dear friend up until the day he died a couple years ago. And I remember catching up with them in Buffalo. And we go to, after the matches, we were at the hotel there. It was like a Hilton, I believe. And we have a certain area marked off for us, bar area. And always, and Tim was really good. Tim could, handle his hands. He was a sparring partner of Marvelous Marvin Hagler years ago. So Tim knew how to take care of himself. He knew how to take care of Andre. So I remember a couple of drunks tried to start something. And Tim just turned his back and just put his hands up and said, not tonight, fellas. Not tonight, not tomorrow night, never. And afterwards, I looked at Tim and I said, how did you know this was going to happen? He goes, you can feel it. You can sense it. And he goes, it happens every night. But getting back to Andre, he's sitting there with my wife to be and asking her, what color are her bridesmaids' gowns are going to be, and ask if he could be invited to the wedding. And I said, yeah, when there's a wedding. I said, May 14th, 1988. He goes, I'll be in Hartford working that night. I cannot come. And this was the previous November, so he knew 6 months in advance where he was booked. I mean, it was crazy, but people thought that Andre the Giant was coming to our wedding here in town. There were a lot of people that showed up at the church hoping that he was going to be there, and some of the other wrestlers. Unfortunately, nature of the business, they're working. They're not coming to weddings.
So what ultimately led to your departure from the WWF?
I was going to get married to a girl here from Auburn, and 4 years was a good time. 4 years was a good run. However, I always said that if I don't get out of this business, I'll be buried in some St. Joseph's Cemetery somewhere. This was the 1980s. This was the Wild Woolly 1980s. This was when they found out that we were part of the WWF. We were all rock stars in any town. So we were treated like rock stars. And it got a little crazy sometimes. It's just like, oh my God. And did we have groupies? No, but could we have? Oh yeah. I mean, it was just nuts, but I got a little bit, it got a little bit loud about, you know, my intentions that I was going to leave the company, and I was up for a review in August of 1987. And when I went in for my review, they gave me my walking papers and my severance and a severance package. And I went on my way, and that was fine. I have no problem with that in any way, shape or form. You know, 4 years in that bit. But here's the thing. It's a merit badge when you're fired by Vince McMahon, because everybody gets fired by Vince.
Yeah, that's right. Part of the club.
Nobody goes unscathed. I mean, that's poor right. Howard Finkel hung on, but he ended up dying, you know, to separate from the company. But everybody goes.
That's right.
And you are just a talent to Vince. You don't know what your shelf like is, only Vince knows that.
Absolutely.
And that's just the way it goes. And I ran into Vince. I harbored a little bit of an ill feeling. And a few years later, you know, a couple months before the drug trial, I caught up with Vince in Syracuse, the Hotel Syracuse. And I was fired up and I wanted to talk to him. I said, I got to talk to you. And I'm pointing my finger at him in the whole nine yards. And, Tim White's yelling, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. And I said, yeah, I'm going to do it. And had my conversation with him. It wasn't heated. And we shook hands, and I wished him the best of luck on the drug trial. And at that time, he wasn't wearing a neck brace. But, you know, that, a couple weeks later, he's wearing a neck brace.
Yeah,
you know?
He was, yeah.
And guess what? Not too long ago, he's wearing a neck brace.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's like, oh, my God, you know, things come around full circle.
Absolutely.
And I'm not going to even comment about the stuff with women in the past and things. Let me give you a little secret. Yeah. It's been going on for years. just some nutty stuff. I mean,
absolutely.
But, you know, hey, you know, that's his decision. That's his life. And who am I to judge? You know, I mean, it is what it is. But no, I mean, it was a good run. You know, I really never brought up wrestling in my household. When my daughters were young, we'd flip through the station. They'd be on my lap, and I'd flip by a wrestling show, and oh my God, they went crazy. We never talked about it, but somehow they knew. They demanded that I go back to it.
Yeah,
like, and I just sat there, and I just. And my wife would come in the room, and you could see the eye roll. You could feel you could hear the eye roll in her head. And it's like, what are you doing? They wanted this. I didn't. But was funny when they were young girls and, you know, go to school. What did your daddy do? Well, he does this now, but he used to work in professional wrestling. And these little boys back then, their eyes got big. And when they got older and I would go to school functions, I see these little boys and their eyes got big. And when your daughters get older, you always worry about them being with the right kids, right boys. And so same boys would see me and their eyes got big. And now my daughters are in their 30s. And when we see some of these guys, their eyes still get big. So it's just like, I never let them off the hook all these years, you know, that's just like, no, no, no. These are my daughters. This is my, my blood, and you're not messing with them.
That's right. Well, and thank you for coming on and talking to me. Like I said, this is a whole new aspect of the business that a lot of, you know, we don't hear about a lot of times, right? I talk to a lot of wrestlers and things like that, but you know, we don't get to see this side of it. So I appreciate you giving me the time to talk to me. And maybe we'll have you back on again in the future, because it sounds like you still got Plenty more stories that you could tell us from your time involved in
Oh,
WWF.
yeah, we're just warming up here, pal. It really
There you
is.
go. There
I
you go.
mean,
Well,
it's I appreciate it. Thanks so much for the opportunity to
absolutely.
get out here and say my piece and my footnote information of pro wrestling history.
Absolutely. And everybody go get Brad's book and check out the 5 pages that Ed's on in that book. And it's a good book anyway. It's a very highly recommended book. And
Oh, absolutely. If you want to
yeah.
know about the wrestling business, that's the one that you'll learn from.
Gene Jackson here, inviting you to join us for the Retro Wrestling Review Podcast, where each week I'm joined by guest co-host, review and discuss old school pro wrestling. Right now, we're doing week-by-week reviews of USWA Memphis from 1993. We have an audio version of the podcast as well as a video version if you want to check out the clips of the show we're talking about. It's a lot of fun, so for this and a lot of other great wrestling content, check out WrestleCopia.com. That's WrestleCopia.com.
All right, welcome back to Wrestling Nostalgia. Special thanks to Ed Helensky for coming on and doing that interview. Lots of fun. Like I said, lots of great information on there, stuff that you don't always hear customarily, right? It's a whole side of the business that a lot of us don't get to hear a lot about. So hopefully you enjoyed that. In closing, make sure you follow me on X at the Dave Dynasty. Go check out all of the WrestleCopia network of podcasts. Next episode that comes out next week, I will have Mike Quackenbush on. Obviously an independent wrestling star, co-founder of Chikara Wrestling, and trainer extraordinaire. It was a fascinating conversation. Just absolutely blew my mind. So much fun. Mike is such a great guy. So intelligent. What a mind for the business. What a mind for training. You are going to love this talk. And I have lots of other great episodes coming up. Lots of really great guests. Some guys that you don't get to hear often. Some pretty big names. I'm always working hard finding new guests, finding unique guests. So make sure you subscribe so that you never miss an episode. But until next week, when we return with another brand new episode, wherever you go and whatever you do, be good, be safe, and always keep on growing.
Fans, we've brought you All-Star Championship Wrestling. This is Sam Menninger thanking you for being with us and saying until next time, so long, everyone.